This is Mumia Abu-Jamal from Imprisoned Nation. You're listening to listener-sponsored KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. KPFK, powered by the people.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Afrofuturism is a genre movement rooting elements of science fiction and fantasy in traditions from Africa and the diaspora, and its popularity as a form of resistance is on the rise. But Afrofuturist concepts have been prevalent in music and literature since the 1950s. You've got jazz musician Sun Ra and authors Samuel R. Delaney and Octavia Butler.
The surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world. And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing.
On this episode, authors Nalo Hopkinson, Nettie Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez sit down with John Jennings at the San Francisco Public Library as part of the 2016 Black Comics Festival. They discuss the role of Afrofuturist thought in the modern context and the importance of allowing ourselves to imagine.
When I sit down to write, I don't think I'm an Afrofuturist writer. I'm going to write an Afrofuturist whatever.
Nalo Hopkinson.
I'll happily claim the adjective. It happened after I started writing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a label that people use to try and pull together a pattern that they're seeing. And in so much as what it is, it's useful. But it is also not as simple as I'm just a writer. Of course, I'm not just a writer. I am everything that I am. But the Afrofuturism part is it's got to be somewhere else when I write, or it will stop me. I'm writing science fiction fantasy, so there's a lot of research that goes into it, and a lot of, not just research, but theorizing, because of course the history books leave stuff out. So you have to imagine yourself into those places. I'm researching the future, I'm researching the past, I'm researching black history, Caribbean history, white history. I barely stayed awake through a history class when I was in school. And now, if you look at my shelves, that stuff is all over the place. And I discover the more I go into it, the more I realize that human beings are human beings. You can reach back into the very beginning of time when human beings are human beings, and we aren't that different. And there's something healing about being able to go back into African histories and African cultures and African ways of life and see that what we are capable of, which you know, but to see it proven over and over and over and over again as the centuries go by and the centuries go forward.
I definitely look into my past.
Nettie Okorafor.
I am what I consider Niger-American, which means Niger is slang for Nigerian, and I'm American. So Nigerian-American. I was born and raised in this country, but from a young age, my parents were taking me back to, my siblings and I, back to Nigeria to reconnect with our heritage, reconnect with our family. Most of our family is there. And then also just being Nigerian American in the house, within that culture, within the Igbo culture, those old traditions and ways have seeped into who I am as well. So those all manifest themselves. My Nigerian Americanness definitely manifests itself in my work. I deal a lot with the traditional spiritualities, especially of the Igbo people, but of other parts of the continent as well. One example are masquerades. Masquerades show up in my works a lot. Masquerades are found in many different African cultures, but I have a lot of what I write about comes from personal experience. So my personal experience with masquerades. Masquerades are they're manifestations of the dead and the ancestors and spirits. They can look in, there are many different types. Some can look very monstrous, just raffia in cloth, that they can look like monsters, and those are the ones that I've been obsessed with. And so when I was a kid, whenever we'd go back to Nigeria, the masquerades would come out around Christmas time, that's a whole other issue. You come out around Christmas time, and because my sisters and I were American Nigerians, they would harass us the most. And they would literally chase us down the street. Okay, they would chase us. They had a whip, and they would whip people, and they would chase us down the street with the whip. And luckily, we were fast, so we weren't caught too many times. So when I think back, I'm like, okay. And a lot of times we would outrun them. And so when I think back, I'm like, oh, I was outrunning the spirits. Mm-hmm. And so in my own stories, you see the masquerades show up a lot in my stories, and they show up in the way that I imagine them, because I've seen the really big, terrifying ones at weddings, and all the women just run to the other side of the room. It's really quite epic. And in my stories, because I'm writing speculative fiction, I can imagine those masquerades the way I see them, which is as they're not people or men in particular dressed up in these elaborate costumes who then take on the ancestor or the spirit. They are that creature. Mm. And so in my stories, I can do that. I can show them that way. And I have a lot of fun with it. So I do look in the past.
I would love to hear if people have specifics about what prompted them to write their first.
Jewel Gomez.
Mine was based on a very specific incident that happened to me in the mid-80s. Does anybody here remember telephone booths? Okay. I was in a telephone booth at the corner of my street. I guess my phone wasn't working, or I had rebelled and not paid the bill. But so I was in the phone booth, and these two guys walked by me and went into their whole thing. Oh, baby, let me suck your blah, 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 blah. And I want to do this to you. And, oh, you're looking so good, as if that would interest me, their opinion. And I was talking to my friend, Marianne, and she said, what's going on? I said, hold on a second. I turned and looked at them, and I said, please go away. And then I turned back to Marianne. Well, of course, they didn't go away. They just went on and on. I said, hold on. I turned around. I said, mother, I will kill you if you don't get a fuck with me. And one of the guys said, this is crazy. And the other guy was just kept on going. I said, yes, I am crazy, and I will kill you. And used a lot of that language that my grandmother had asked me not to use. And the one guy dragged the other guy away. And this was on West End Avenue and 93rd Street in Manhattan. My adrenaline had gone through my body like crazy. I was so happy there was nothing at hand for me to pick up.
Right.
Because they keep West End Avenue kind of clean. So my friend, Marianne, I heard her screaming, Jewel, 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 because she thought I was killing someone. And so I said, Marianne, I can't talk. I have to go home. I can't talk. So I went home, and I caught my breath, and I sat down, and I wrote the first Gilda story. Mm. Wow. And it was a woman walking in on the street, and a guy does that to her, and, of course, she kills him.
I'm so going to use that when I teach the Gilda stories.
Tosses his body in the river. So I decided I better use my powers for good.
Please.
And over time, evolved the vampire mythology, because that's really what I realized I was working on, so that she didn't have to kill people, and developed the whole philosophy around it. So that fit into my political, mm-hmm. social political philosophy, mm-hmm. as a lesbian feminist. And I felt the surrealists believed that you have to first change your dreams in order to change the world.
Right.
And I feel that that's what speculative fiction, any kind of speculative fiction, people writing black comics, they're imagining a better world. They're dreaming a better world, a different world. And I realized that's what I wanted to spend my life doing as opposed to, you know, killing people on the street.
I keep going back to Walter Mosley, who you may or may not know, has written science fiction novels and short stories.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And I'm going to paraphrase him, but he basically said, we need a better world, and in order to have a better world, in order to make it, we first need to be able to imagine it. Mm-hmm. And also Samuel R. Delaney, mentor of mine, who said, we need visions of the future, and our people need them more than most. Mm-hmm. So,
That's right.
It was true then, true now. And so there is very much a connection. And I sort of also think, the work is there. The work needs to be done. It's desperate. But we also need to be able to enjoy, to have fun, to have imagination, to have passion, because why else are we doing this? So I think we also need to give ourselves permission to enjoy. The work is there and we will do it. So there's very much a connection between allowing ourselves to imagine, allowing ourselves to think that we get to, like anybody else, have fun, and using that to fuel the vision of what it is we're trying to make. Sometimes I just want to write strange stories set in strange places. My own reality will always seep into those stories. But I want to hold on to the fact that we get to do all of it.
Right. Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking about the word using these narratives for social justice. Mm-hmm. And I'm very resistant to that.
Yeah.
Because I know that when I sit down and to write something, I'm not thinking that, okay, I want to make this point. You know, this is something I want to show the world about whatever. Mm-hmm. When it comes down to it, when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just letting it flow. I'm a very subconscious writer where oftentimes I don't even have an outline. Mm-hmm. I don't even know who the character is. I'll just sit down and just start. Right. And whatever is flowing through me is what will flow through me. So the idea of using the narrative for something is foreign to me. I mean, I understand other writers, other artists who operate like that, but for me, I definitely don't. But I do know that I'm very much a political person. So those ideas and what I want to see, the changes that I want to see and the things that I want to do and want to see done, those are already there. Those are things that I might have conversations about when I'm not writing. But when I sit down to write, those things come through in a more indirect way. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I deal with my books tend to be very political, and it's not that I sat down and thought, okay, I want to write this political story. It's just that they are because I am.
Right.
Yeah, I would say the same. I think I might be a little more conscious of it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I start out to write agitprop, but having come of age, you know, in the civil rights movement, the black arts movement, all of the work that people were doing was an expression of liberation and opening new worlds to us, the worlds of blackness. So I think I started writing in a very conscious way about blackness, the same as being a feminist. I started writing very consciously about women and how women are placed in the world. At the same time, I don't want to write a tract, you know, so people will just, you know, snore. But I think though, having come of age in those particular movements make me much more conscious of it as I'm doing it. And I think that's one of the interesting things for this, going from African Americans saying, how dare you write a vampire novel with African Americans in it. How could you do that? How could you connect those things? To, you know, 25 years later, as my vampire novel is about to have its 25th anniversary, to see the community come full circle and say, oh yeah, we're going to claim this and we're going to give it its own name, Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really great. And in part, I think that's because the political evolution on campuses, in communities who are starting to understand their economics has to be taken in their own hands.
Right.
They can't wait for the government to fix it. That racism, sexism, any of the isms really need to be in our hands. How we fight them need to be in our hands. And I think that is a sign of hope. And I think that's one of the reasons that our writing has started to spread out into these fields, into Black comics, into future Afrofuturism, and other speculative fictions. I think it's a sign of hope.
You're listening to Afrofuturist Authors. Nalo Hopkinson is the author of 9 books, from Brown Girl in the Ring to the Nebula Award-winning Sister Mine. Nnedi Okorafor writes African-based science fiction for both children and adults, including the Nebula and Hugo Award-winning Binti series. And Jewel Gomez is a writer, activist, and the author of the Double Lambda Award-winning novel, The Gilda Stories. Her dream play, Waiting for Giovanni, is about James Baldwin. Now let's rejoin the conversation as our three authors discuss the monsters that have captured their imagination and what they hope to see in the future of Afrofuturism.
For me, the idea that genre fiction, and I usually say speculative fiction to cover everything as an umbrella term, but I think speculative fiction is really an easy way for a large population to find themselves and find their politics. Mm. Any kind of genre fiction, whether it's detective stories, whether it's cartoons, whether it's a romance, I know you find that hard to believe, but any kind of genre fiction can get away with telling a political story. And if it's a genre fiction, more different kinds of people are going to read it because they feel like, oh, this is just going to be fun. And then when they finish, they realize, oh wow, I thought about that. That was deep. And whoa. And, you know, you saw Star Trek do it with issues around race. We see all kinds of TV speculative fiction shows introduce complex ideas. And I think the more of us who write and start writing younger, the more complex ideas we will put in genre fiction, and the more of us who will read them and become increasingly conscious of our political surroundings.
I hope it gives more people permission to know that they can imagine and that they can make stories. I mean, I think the three of us were at Astro Blackness a few months ago, and there was a young woman in the audience, Black woman, who also loved horror and didn't think she could write it because she kept imagining Black characters until she found an ARC, an advanced reading copy of one of Octavia Butler's novels on the streetcar or whatever they do in LA. And then it was like her imagination broke open and now she's writing. And it cuts to my heart that somebody thinks that because they've never seen it, they can't do it. So that's where I would hope it's going, is that more of us have just sort of know that we can stand up and make what we imagine.
You've been listening to writers Nalo Hopkinson, Nnedi Okorafor, and Jewel Gomez. A big thank you to the San Francisco Public Library for recording.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button.
I was turning the radio dial on the car, trying to find something other than the usual dribble and fluff and nothingness on the rest of the airwaves. And I just stumbled across KPFK, and I was just drawn to it like a magnet, and I was just listening to it intently. And all of a sudden, I said, I have got to pull off the freeway here. I found the nearest telephone booth. I called my wife and said, you have got to turn on 90.7 FM. I will talk to you when I get home. This is incredible. What I noticed was different right away was that people were being interviewed at length. And when they were talking about the purpose for the station, the reason for being was to promote understanding among peoples of all races and from all countries and all classes, and to provide information about the events of the world that were not reported or not reported completely or in depth by any of the other major news outlets, broadcast or print. And I just thought that was phenomenal. And I've been blessed ever since.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
I'm Amy Gastelum. I am so excited to bring you a conversation between two thought leaders in our nationwide conversation about race and diversity. Ijeoma Oluo is a speaker and the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race. Ruchika Tolshian is a writer and an expert on inclusive leadership. The two women are longtime friends and colleagues, so this chat is warm and it's funny and it's familiar. But it also invites the listener in as if to say, come on over here, sit by us. This conversation happened at a public event at Town Hall Seattle. It's about Tolshian's best-selling book, Inclusion on Purpose, An Intersectional Approach to Creating a Culture of Belonging at Work. To get us started, here's Ijeoma Oluo. Enjoy.
I would just love to know, like, why this book, you know, what kind of brought you into this space and what was your thinking as you were engaging, you know, in your research and writing for it?
This book is me making up for my follies and in some ways my sins of talking about gender diversity just as an issue that faced women. And when I said women, what I really meant, or whom I was centering by just saying women, were white women. And so this is my book. This is my learning in public, correct myself in public, and say, actually, if we really want to create an inclusive workplace, it's not good enough just to say women need to progress in the workplace. It's women of color and centering Black, Indigenous, and Latinx women. And that is really at the highest level what this book is about. The other thing that I want to talk about is how this statistic I read, which I think was life-changing for me, which is 3/4 of white people in America don't have a single friend of color, and 91% of the average white person's social network is white. And I think when I read that statistic, suddenly it's as if all the puzzle pieces of my life as an immigrant in America suddenly made sense. I was like, oh, that's why the majority of people I meet don't know what to do with me. They're like, okay, so you have a funny name and you say you grew up outside this country, but your English is very normal. I've been told that. And you can communicate with us, but you're also different. Like, there's this mental calculation that goes on. And it makes sense. It's because for a lot of, especially white people, they have never met someone who is different than them or really materially connected with someone who's different than them. And then the same study that I read at that time said that the first time for a lot of white people that they really interact meaningfully with someone who's different than them racially is in the workplace. And it's literally like all the puzzle pieces fell together because, or fit together for me, because I've always been interested in the workplace. I've always been interested in leadership and management. I know that especially in capitalist societies, sadly, you know, businesses have an outsized impact on what happens, right, in our social lives. You know, even when we think about parental leave, I speak to women who get 20, 30, 40 weeks of paid, you know, maternity leave because they work for a high-tech firm. And then I speak to women who go back, you know, 1 in 4 mothers in America go back to work 10 days after giving birth, right? And they're not the ones working in the high-tech industry. And so we know that corporate employers have an outsized influence in how society operates and the experience of people. And so for me, those all those pieces really fell together. And as I started researching the book, researching for the book, speaking to women of color for their stories on the deep pain and trauma, I started finding healing within myself. I started finding healing for all those experiences, both in the workplace and outside the workplace, where I had really experienced marginalization, being overlooked, being underestimated. And I found healing in connecting with other women of color, centering as much as I possibly could underestimated women of color, and writing this book, knowing that there is a power in sharing our stories and moving the needle in the workplace and hopefully beyond.
That's beautiful. That's lovely. And to stay in kind of a personal space, when you were talking about, you know, how your earlier work kind of centered white women, I was imagining people looking at you and going, wait, what? How? What? Because you're not white. Visibly, you are not white. But I think that that's interesting because this is a thing we have talked about in the past, which is the immigrant experience as a person of color, especially a privileged immigrant experience, has layers that can often stop you from seeing your experience as a racialized one. Because there are so many other things. One, it can be your class that brought you here, that puts you in a space where you never had to consider the possibility of being seen outside of gender norms, but also all of the xenophobia and all of the other, you know, things that you do experience that everyone, especially people of color, experience when they come here that can seem like its own thing, not really related to race, even though I would say white men coming from France do not experience the same issues in a workspace that a woman of color would. And then there's also the ways in which we are not able to always keep in mind the ways in which our lives were shaped by white supremacy, even if we grew up in a majority place of color, right? So I'm a black woman who grew up, you know, born and raised in the U.S., but also my father was a Nigerian immigrant, and I have siblings who've just been here a few years, and I can see the difference in it and that disconnect. And a lot of it, when people talk to me and say, I don't feel connected to this struggle, I don't understand where my space is in it, a lot of it is because the ways in which white supremacy has shaped your life through colonialism,
yes,
through capitalism, has not been made as readily apparent, and the connections to how people of color are treated in this country haven't been made. And so it was interesting to watch as you became more aware of that, and we talked about your kind of understanding as not only you are a woman of color and you are treated as a woman of color, but still you have an abundance of privilege that shapes how you walk through the world. And I'm glad that you were coming to that awareness before you started writing this book, because I can see in how you centered people. Were there things in the research of this book in your conversations with women who, and other people of color who had less privilege, that still continued to educate or surprise you in these discussions?
Oh my gosh, so much. And firstly, I just want to say that there is not an immigrant who comes to the United States and isn't in many subtle and overt ways told that your key to success is by upholding white supremacy and also upholding anti-blackness. There is not an immigrant. I mean, there is research that's shown that even immigrants who appear and present as black are told in subtle and overt ways, you know, the more you distance yourself from the black African-American community, the more you're going to be able to succeed and rise, right? And so I do want to name that, because that is a big failing, I think, that a lot of immigrants with privilege in this country that we have, that we really have done quite a lot of damage in upholding a white supremacy and anti-blackness, and especially in our, from our positions of privilege. So I absolutely want to name that. There was in a moment when I was writing this book, or that I was interviewing someone for this book or studying the research, that I wasn't not only educated, but deeply moved. No, you know, women of color is an incomplete term, and we're certainly not a monolith. We have many, many different experiences. But the one commonality that researching and writing this book taught me is that there's this thread of being underestimated, of being overlooked, and the degrees to which and how quickly you come to that realization very much differs based on your identity. In fact, when I interviewed you for the book, what clicked into place for me is you said something along the lines of, there was not a moment that I came into the workplace and thought that I would belong or be treated properly or equally, right? Like, black women and black children are taught from a really young age, you live in a racist society and this is how you navigate. And something shifted in me, because I was like, wow, because for me as an educated, college-educated brown woman, what I was taught is, as long as you get all the education, you get all the experience, you start making money, of course people are going to treat you properly. Of course they're going to treat you equally. Race doesn't matter. And then that slow burn realization, no, it actually really does. Race and gender, that intersection really does matter. And that was a profound shift for me at when I spoke with you, and then I interviewed other black women that, you know, they didn't have that luxury, you know? You don't have that luxury of thinking you can do anything, you can achieve anything you want, and then realize, no, actually, you know, that's not the case. You know it from day one. That's so interesting. Yeah, I've seen that, you know, and I used to have paid interns, and they were always young women of color, and a lot of them ended up being women of color who weren't black, and it was, they were always at that age where I would get this call a few months in, and they would be in tears because something profoundly racist happened in a space where they thought it would never happen. And recognizing, oh, you're at that age, you know? Because it's not a thing that, you know, I mean, for me, it's my whole life, but I don't know if, I mean, I would say there's a real toll for the ways in which we are robbed of developmental stages, even, right? You are robbed of part of your childhood if your expressions of childhood are punished, and you don't get to go back at 30 and be a five-year-old learning risk and reward, right? But also, it's always been really weird for me to watch someone try to integrate an entire shift in how the world works at 25, 30, 40. You know, because white supremacy does a good job of hiding its animus and its exploitation of people of color who aren't black or native. And I would say part of it, they use the animus towards black and native populations in order to do that, because as long as you're not treated like that, you kind of feel safe in this middle space.
But it's always been interesting for me to watch. And she, I'm always curious about it because it's not, there's so much of the experience I can say, I know. That's not one. And then I wonder further, like, because the funny parts are the emails I get from white women. Just devastated, you know, because they are 42 and they discovered racism is bad and it exists and they don't know what to do with themselves. And I'm just like,
yeah.
Oh,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you poor thing. But also I wonder, like, oh, you know, you're going to have to make a choice now. Do you sit down your partner and your friends and have new expectations of them and set up all new relationships and give up watching those television shows you love and stop participating in the same harmful activities when everyone is expecting this of you? Or do you pretend like you never learned this lesson?
You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy. And that was the kind of story we love to highlight. Not just stories of what's going wrong. We like to bring you stories of activists telling you how they're standing up to injustice, and feminist artists and creatives who are making films and writing books about ways to make change in the world, different ways to see the world. Plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. So that's what we actually mean when we say at the top of the show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist, but also engage. And you can support us to keep doing that right now. You just go to kpfk.org, the website, and you click the donate button. And this is Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. And I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And we're proud to be on KPFK, along with a whole other host of varied voices from the community, but also varied perspectives, perspectives that you're not going to hear anywhere else on the radio dial, not in any of the kind of canned and already digested versions of news that you'll get anywhere else. But right here on KPFK, we're bringing you stories from our activism, from our lives, and from folks that we're excited to share with you. You can support KPFK and our show today. Just go to the kpfk.org website and just click the donate button. It's that easy.
Listen to KPFK when you start your day or throughout the day. How about in the evenings? When you think about it, you probably spend a lot more time with KPFK than you realize. And we thank you for making us a part of your routine. It's truly a privilege to be included in your life, which is one of the main reasons why we do all this. We know that our listeners rely on KPFK programming, and we hope that we can rely on your help for this service to continue. Help KPFK to move the conversation forward. Please pledge your financial support to KPFK right now, if you can, by going to kpfk.org/donate. Or you can dial 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Easy to remember. And we thank you for being part of the family.
Ijeoma Oluo is a speaker and the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race. Ruchika Tolshian is a writer and an expert on inclusive leadership. was a conversation between Ijeoma Oluo and Ruchika Tolshian for Town Hall Seattle, two thought leaders in our nationwide conversation about race and diversity. Ijeoma Oluo is a speaker and the author of several books, including the New York Times bestseller, So You Want to Talk About Race. Ruchika Tolshian is a writer and an expert on inclusive leadership.
One thing I really like about this book is it's a piece that is so rooted in the direct words of women of color in a way that is very unambiguous. And it removes that option of people to pretend like maybe they didn't hear a thing. And I think in work environments, it's very easy to have someone come in, talk about race and racism, leave, and you can pine and pretend like you didn't hear anything they said. And especially the way they're set up, because they're often set up so that someone external comes in, talks about things that never fully connect to what's actually happening in the space, gives some surface-level recommendations that really just reduce HR complaints, and leaves. And then people can be like, oh, yeah. And this book has a lot of very firsthand experience and practical advice in it that makes it hard for people to go, well, okay, but, you know, what if we all just had a chat instead, you know, and didn't do these things? And I'm grateful for that. And I wanted to ask, because I do see some questions coming up around this too, and it's just such a hot topic, right? Everyone talks about DEI right now. Right. And before people became scared of critical race theory, they were terrified of DEI. And I will say, you have a lot more to be afraid of from critical race theory than DEI. DEI can't even scare racists. In the critique, there's a lot that is very valid. And I think there's a lot that people don't understand. And a lot of anger around it is very misplaced, some of it purposefully so. But I was curious if, like, in looking at, you know, the work you've done and trying to be very... I'm saying practical, not in a sense of void of emotion, because I actually think the lived experience and understanding lived experience of people of color is one of the most practical things you can do, but practical in the sense of actionable. In trying to do actionable work while also having been in many spaces that are seeking to do what people know as DEI work, what are some of the gaps do you hope that this book can fill?
Great question. And, you know, Ijeoma, one of the difficulties actually in conceptualizing this book in my head, you know, at least 5 years ago, before actually the murder of George Floyd, at a time where diversity, equity, and inclusion essentially meant gender diversity, white women's progress, etc. And my hope was, you know, I can hopefully change the conversation around that, you know, say there's extreme value in using the words diversity, equity, and inclusion correctly and centering that work correctly and taking it out of this check the box idea. And not that many people are talking about it in a very meaningful way. And I was really, you know, I was very hopeful that, okay, this book, the timing is right and it's going to come out and hopefully people will engage with it. And then the movement for racial justice happened, certainly sparked off by George Floyd's murder. Very, very important movement. And suddenly, everyone was talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. It was like overnight, I saw LinkedIn profiles change to inclusion strategist and diversity guru and equity, whatever it is. And I fear that in many ways, and, you know, I think hearing your question, in many ways, I worry that the work has really been diluted, right, of what it actually, what the essence of it is. Like, what does it actually mean to have a diverse workforce that is made up of people who have largely been underestimated and underrepresented and overlooked? Not how many, you know, different types of white men do you have, right? What does it mean to center equity? Which you're now, it'll always be a process. It's not an outcome. You're looking at barriers and how to remove them. You're looking at inclusion again of people who have not been included in the workplace. It's not, you're not asking again, five white women, whether they are enjoying their experience and they like coming to work.
And so my hope with this book is, even though it's become a hot topic, my hope is that people will also see the other side of how profound and meaningful this work can be if we do it together and we do it correctly. If we center anti-racism in diversity, equity, inclusion efforts. What gives me hope and what makes me optimistic is, until 2 years ago, when I was asked to speak at an organization, I was told, could you please not talk about race? And can you please not mention, you know, racism? When you talk, we just want to talk about diversity. And of course, I would say no, but I would get those requests. And now, you know, I don't know whether it's just because people feel scared to say that to me anymore or something has shifted, but I feel like at least there's some acknowledgement, much more than ever before, of the way that racism is really built into all of our systems and how we're navigating it.
I'm going to give you a tip that you didn't ask for, which is, because I get things like this all the time, absolutely take those gigs, because once that contract's signed,
and the money's wired in.
And the money, it doesn't even matter if the money's wired in. It's actually better if they try to not pay you. Very few companies, racist as they may be, are foolish enough to say, you talked about racism, we're not going to pay the brown person that we came in to talk about inclusion. I have literally had this happen. I actually had a talk that people still walk up to me about, for a certain government organization that wanted me to speak for Dr. Martin Luther King Day and asked me not to bring up a certain youth jail. And I was like, cool. So now I'm only talking about a youth jail. And what are you going to do? That was silly. You should have never said anything. Because it was only going to be a sentence before, and now it's like paragraphs. So always take it. They will pay you. They weren't going to ask you back anyways. And then you get to say the thing that the white person they would have moved on to wasn't going to say.
No.
So take the money and then do the thing anyway. That's
I'm getting so much out of this. This is so good.
You know, it's so funny too, because people are like, you probably shouldn't say that out loud. People won't call you. No, they don't listen to my talks. If you're going to call me and be like, don't talk about this thing, you've never heard of me before in your life. Somebody who hates you told you to call me. And that's on you, because you didn't Google it.
Which, by the way, happens all the time.
And
with the levity, I want to acknowledge, like, as women of color, like, you could be a New York Times bestseller, right? And you could be on Trevor Noah. I mean, you don't need a list of Ijeoma's accomplishments. And yet there will always be those moments that remind you, you know, don't dream too high, you know? Remember, you're still working in our system. You should be more grateful we gave you this opportunity.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, and we were sort of talking about this earlier, because there's a veneer to it. You know, part of the reason why I started doing this work was the realization that there was no, you know, when I was working in corporate spaces, there was no promotion, no amount of financial security that was ever going to buy me the freedom to enter any mixed race space fully as a black woman and be safe and seen and heard and appreciated. That was never going to happen. And in fact, the opposite was going to happen. Mm-hmm. The more that people, quote unquote, gave me, no matter how hard I worked for it, the more I was going to be expected to play along and the more I'd have to lose. And I just decided, well, I can either blow this up at 30 or I can blow this up at 60. It's all about how much of my own time I want to waste. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, quit my job, said I don't want to sell trucks anymore, and started writing full time. But the funny thing is even when you're doing this work, even if your name is rising in doing this work, it still happens. It's like, it's not,
you don't actually, all the behind the scenes is just as toxic. It's still just as exploitative. The only difference is I don't get fired for saying the things that I wanted to say for a long, but there's still things you don't say, right? Yeah. You don't talk about your publisher. you don't talk
unless
about
you're backstage.
Unless you're backstage. And so it's an interesting space, and you still don't get comfortable.
No.
And part of how you navigate it is by the relationships you have and how you get through even doing this work. And I think a lot of times there's this idea that people of color who do any work around race or ethnicity live in this space where, one, we like talking about it all the time, which we don't. But also, oh, well, I'm sure you don't encounter the racism then. Like, who's going to be racist to you? They know who you are. Like, everyone. Everyone.
Literally everyone.
Everyone.
Literally.
And it's so ingrained in society.
It really is.
What keeps you going? And because I know that a lot of times when I talk with other people, like, there are regular body blows of just like, oh, come on, I just want to do this thing. That can be really discouraging when you're doing the work. And you do a lot of work, right? So you're not just the author of this book. You're mm-hmm. also a teacher, mm-hmm. a speaker, an educator. And what keeps you going in this work?
I hope it doesn't sound trite, but it's because I have a 5-year-old brown boy who's going to grow up in America, who is growing up in America and is American. And just the way the experience I had when I said to my mom during one, birthday party where my friend called me the night before and she said, I can't come to your birthday party. My mom said, I can't come to your birthday party because you're Indian. That's going to happen to my son as well. And I don't want that to continue on. I'm truly fighting for a world where I don't know if I can prevent it, right? I don't know if I can prevent it. He's already 5. But really for as much as I possibly can, for our kids, right? Mm-hmm. That's really what keeps me motivated. That's what keeps me going. Because otherwise it is so hard to do this work.
That's beautiful, and I think a wonderful way to end this talk. And I'm so proud of you, and this is wonderful, and I know that y'all will love this book, and I'm just really glad it's out there in the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you to all of you. Thank you.
I'm Amy Gastelum. This is Making Contact. That was a conversation between Ijeoma Oluo and Ruchika Tolshian for Town Hall Seattle. I listened to Tolshian's book, Inclusion on Purpose, while I was working in my garden, and I did not use headphones. It was blasting through a speaker, so my neighbors heard it too. I have to tell you, the book includes real stories from women of color about their experiences of exclusion and bias in the workplace. But it also offers practical, actionable ideas for organizational leaders so that they can make change. Get into it.
Support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button or call 818-985-5735. So during this fund drive, we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air.
providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times, and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. That whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA. But we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing. To keep KPFK sustainable, you give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. And speaking of love, we love getting feedback from listeners about the show. We've been getting great feedback on our programming during this fund drive. And, you know, like Mothers of the Revolution we covered recently, and somebody wrote in saying that seeing that movie about the anti-nuke movement reminded her how she got involved in activism and then moved into climate justice. It's part of an ongoing wave of being part of making change. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
Escucha Contragolpe. Programa que informa sobre lo que realmente impacta a nuestra sociedad. Hablamos sobre nuestra música, costumbres, identidad, historia y política. Con una tónica diferente, ligera e informal, buscamos despertar la conciencia y la reflexión mediante el combate a la farsa y el llamado balance informativo. Todos los miércoles de 9:30 a 10:30 de la noche.
With FEMA's recent announcement that the LA Fire Disaster Recovery Center at Pasadena City College permanently closed at 8 p.m. on Friday, January 31st, there are still two recovery centers that will remain open from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. In West LA at UCLA Research Park West, 10850 West Pico Boulevard,
and at the Altadena Disaster Recovery Center, 540 West Woodbury Road in Altadena. At these centers, anyone who suffered damage to their home, lost personal property, or have emergency needs caused by the fires can get help applying for federal assistance, speak with representatives from state and federal agencies, and receive updates on their FEMA assistance application, or learn about the appeals process if their application was denied. You can also apply for FEMA assistance